Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, a full-scale replica of Fort Mosse is being built. We'll talk with archaeologist Kathy Deegan, who discovered the location of the Free Black Settlement.
I first learned about Fort Mosse when I was a student at the University of Florida in the early 1970s.
We'll discuss the field diary of Andrew A. Humphreys, who began his military career during the Second Seminole War.
Humphreys complained bitterly about military leadership, the field decisions, and the lack of federal support.
And we'll talk about film in Florida and Florida in film. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Fort Mosse Historic State Park has broken ground on a full-scale replica of Fort Mosse to be completed this year at a cost of $933,000. Established in 1738 by Manuel Montiano, governor of Spanish colonial Florida, Fort Mosse was the first free black settlement to be legally established in what would become the United States. Renowned Florida archaeologist Kathy Deegan discovered the site of Gracia Real de Santa Teresa de Mosse, better known as Fort Mosse, just north of St. Augustine.
I first learned about Fort Mosse when I was a student at the University of Florida in the early 1970s, and one of my professors, Charles Fairbanks, was very interested in learning more about Fort Mosse, and I was a student on one of the digs he brought over here to St. Augustine to try and locate it.
Deegan built on the work of Fairbanks, leading her own excavations at the Fort Mosse site in the mid-1980s. She was able to conclusively identify the location of the fort on an island in the middle of a wet, marshy area.
It is an area that is hard to work in because it's in the middle of a marsh, and much of the marsh area has been dredged, so you couldn't exactly walk there and you couldn't really take a vehicle of any kind. But for some reason, the dredging in this area managed to leave the spot where the fort itself is intact, and we've often wondered if those 19th century earth movers had a sense that that's where the fort was. But for archaeologists, it was a matter of putting on your high boots and slogging through the mud. And we had a lot of students out there. We issued them all their black rubber boots. And once you're on the actual site itself, which is a small marsh island here behind me, it is high ground. We learned that the site actually has been occupied by people for hundreds and hundreds of years. There was a prehistoric Tumuqua Indian site there, and then very briefly there was an Apalachee mission after 1704, and then Fort Mosse. And so once you're on the site, it's normal excavation, digging through shell and dirt and tree roots.
Deegan and her team were able to provide context for the discoveries that they made on the small marsh island north of St. Augustine, proving that they had uncovered the site of Fort Mosse.
A lot of the archaeological work at Fort Mosse actually was oriented toward the architecture. It was necessary for us to show that this was, in fact, Fort Mosse. And so it was really exciting to us when we were able to plot the moat and dig and locate where the moat itself for the fort was in several places, and it really had to be Fort Mosse. The artifacts were of the right time period. There weren't a lot of artifacts, but they were all really interesting. Some things you would associate with soldiers, uniform buttons, lots of rum bottles, tobacco pipes, and things you'd associate with family life. thimbles and pins, buttons, pottery for cooking, pottery for eating. And it was just, I think, an exciting process to suddenly realize, yes, this is the site of the place that there's been so much controversy about. And where was it? Did it really exist? Was even, you know, the thinking in some ways.
The population of the community at Fort Mosse consisted primarily of former slaves who had escaped from British colonies to the north into Spanish-controlled Florida. The Spanish government encouraged this immigration of British slaves by granting them freedom in exchange for their conversion to Catholicism and a pledge to defend St. Augustine from British invasion. Kathy Deegan.
Yes, when the people arrived here from the plantations in the Carolinas, they were obligated to become Catholic in order to gain freedom, to be emancipated. It was a religious sanctuary, is the way the Spaniards looked at it. And there doesn't seem to be any indication at all that this was problematical or distasteful to any of the people of Mosse. They had their children baptized in the church. Their records are there. They had godparents and throughout the town. And so from every outward appearance, they fully embraced the notion of religious conversion. Now, whether they thought that, we don't know, but we didn't, for example, find any kind of material culture that would suggest one of the syncretic religions that you see so often in Latin America, where Catholicism is blended with a non-Christian tradition. We didn't see that at all at Mosse, but that doesn't mean people weren't thinking.
Meticulous research of historical documents combined with the material discoveries at the Fort Mosse site produced a much more complete picture of what life was like for people of African descent in 18th century Florida.
There are times when I have thought the best thing that came out of the archaeology was the history. Because as part of the project, really before we begin, we always want to have a real historian search the records, do original research, so we just don't find out what they really already knew. And at that time, in really the 70s and early 80s, the thinking was that there's disenfranchised people, African Americans, slaves, women, children, poor people, didn't have a history. And the idea was it's up to the archaeologists to provide a history of words from the earth. But when Jane Landers, who was a graduate student working with me at the time, went to Spain to specifically look for information about the people of Mosse, we were all astounded at the amount of detail there was and how much information there is. Sometimes you just have to ask the right question to find it. So the original research that came out of the project, I think, has been a major contribution to Florida history.
Today, Fort Mosse is known as the first legally sanctioned free black community in what is now the United States. Prior to Kathy Deegan identifying the site of Fort Mosse, the fascinating history of the community was not well known.
Before the archaeological program, there really wasn't very much awareness at all of Fort Mosse. There were a few scholarly articles, but they weren't in mainstream sort of publications that everyone would read about. And the history wouldn't have been unknown or lost without the archaeology, because there were always some people who knew it was here. But I think it brought it to a much wider understanding and appreciation, and the ripples that came out of that have really lasted down to today, and we hope into the future, in terms of community interest and awareness.
Francisco Menendez escaped slavery to begin a new life in Florida. His military skill and bravery defending St. Augustine from attack led to his being named head of the militia at Fort Mosse.
The leader of the group at Fort Mosse and the head of the militia, Francisco Menendez, has to be one of the most interesting people and colorful people in Florida history, maybe even American history. He was a Mandingo. He came to the Carolinas probably as a youth and escaped slavery. He allied with the Yamasee Indians in their fight against the English at the Yamasee War, came with the Yamasee to Florida. It went through several series of being betrayed and sold into slavery and escaping. He was a corsair. He was apparently a well-educated person. He could write and did write, and was his story is really remarkable. You wouldn't really believe it if you saw it in a movie. You would think it was invented.
The community of Fort Mosse was short-lived. When the British took control of Florida from Spain in 1763, Fort Mosse was abandoned.
When Florida was ceded to England in exchange for Havana after the end of the Seven Years' War, all of the residents of St. Augustine left rather than stay and live with the Protestant English. And all of the people of Mosse were among them. There were 86 people at Mosse then, and they all went to Cuba, to the province of Matanzas, where some of them stayed, many of them left and moved back to Havana. But the records of their lives have been uncovered in Cuba, again by Jane Landers, who is learning their fate and if there might even be some descendants today.
Fort Mosse Historic State Park is located 2 miles north of St. Augustine. The Interpretive Museum on site will now be joined by a full-scale replica of Fort Mosse to be completed this year. Kathy Deegan is Distinguished Research Curator and Professor Emerita from the University of Florida. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Second Seminole War is one of the most frequent topics for the Florida Historical Quarterly, but in 2006, Matthew T. Piercy, an historian with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, found a diary in the Pennsylvania Historical Society archives from 1836 that shed new light on the conflict. His article on the war and the diary won the prize for Best Article of the Year awarded by the U.S. Government Historical Society.
That's right. I was invited to Washington, D.C. for the award ceremony and have a copy of the award hanging on my office wall. The subject of the article and the author of the diary was Andrew A. Humphreys, a well-known scientist, engineer, and Civil War general whose extensive collection of papers is housed in Pennsylvania, his home state. Scholars have used this collection to write extensively about Humphreys, but always focusing on his later accomplishments. The 1831 West Point graduate spent his early career with the 2nd Artillery Regiment at Fort Moultrie, South Carolina, before being transferred to St. Augustine, 1833-34, and serving with the topographical engineers in West Florida, 1834-35. In February 1836, he reported for duty at Fort Drane, writing, quote, "I delight in extremes, and certainly my profession leads to them. From the center of civilization to the wildest forests, I am transferred in a few days. In January, luxuriating in the delights of our capital, in February, suffering from hunger, thirst, and fatigue in the hammocks of Florida," end quote. As this introduction suggests, Humphreys' diary and letters, which cover the period February to August 1836, offer some of the sharpest criticisms of the war. Piercy notes that Humphreys' quote, "journal represents one of very few in-the-field diary accounts of the Second Seminole War," end quote. As such, it provides, quote, "a new and authoritative perspective on important aspects of that war, including the distrust and hostility that characterize relations between regular and militia forces, the collusions between Seminole Maroons and plantation slaves bent on insurrection, and the generally poor quality of military leadership in the theater, end quote.
Connie, this six-year war, the longest and costliest of the Indian Wars, was characterized by fiercely fought small engagements, environmental challenges, and frequent outbreaks of disease.
Humphrey's diary touches on each of these. He was particularly critical of the militia, who served for three-month periods. Quote, "Thus it is," he wrote in May, "that a small force of regulars sustained the burden of the whole war. When a large body of militia is called into the field, we starve ourselves to death to provision them and teach them their duty. Then they are not willing pupils, but think they confer a great favor by coming to help us, as though it was a private quarrel of ours. From the bottom of my heart, I wish never to see another militiaman in the field. But then, as soon as we get rid of this swarm of locusts, the militia, the enemy show themselves in force, and we are a mere handful of men, must fight the only battles that are fought," end quote. Humphreys complained bitterly about military leadership, the field decisions, and the lack of federal support. The commander who received his unqualified respect was Major Julius Frederick Heilemann, a veteran of the War of 1812, who arrived in Florida, quote, "thin and pale," end quote. Despite his appearance, Heilemann was a man of action, as Humphrey noted. Quote, "In Florida, the course has been to fortify and starve and to leave any unfortunate man shot outside the pickets to lie in his gore and perish of thirst, if not of his wounds. We are glad to see that Major Heilemann has taught those under his command to emerge from the breastworks panic," end quote. The ever-present environmental challenges proved the final straw for Humphreys. Describing conditions as deplorable, he listed filth, poor food, heat, and disease as responsible for the deaths of, quote, "as many as five soldiers each day," end quote. For those who lived, quote, "sandflies and mosquitoes were innumerable, centipedes, cockroaches, scorpions, and immense spiders were daily tenants of the place. The sand of the fort was full of chiggers and a sort of black flea. This latter was the greatest pest to us of all," end quote. Humphrey's physical courage and composure under fire were no match for the environment. Already unhappy with the way the war was waged, and initially passed over for promotion despite praise from his superiors and Governor Richard Call, he began considering resignation of his commission. His own illness, possibly yellow fever, proved the final straw. He resigned his commission and returned to Pennsylvania, where he spent the next 2 years under a doctor's care recovering from the physical effects of his service in Florida.
But Connie, that wasn't the end of Humphrey's military career or his contributions to the nation, right?
No, indeed. He returned to the military after his recovery, joining the newly organized Army Corps of Topographical Engineers, initially conducting surveys and overseeing harbor improvements and bridge building. In 1850, he oversaw the survey of the lower Mississippi River, producing, quote, "the most thorough analysis of the Mississippi River ever completed," end quote, the massive Report upon the Physics and Hydraulics of the Mississippi River, 1861. He also directed the Pacific Railroad surveys, 1853 to 1857, to identify the most practical and economical route for the nation's first transcontinental railroad. His work achieved international acclaim, and he was invited into membership in the prestigious American Philosophical Society. During the Civil War, he fought at Fredericksburg and Gettysburg. He became the chief of staff to Major General George G. Meade during the battles of the Wilderness and Cold Harbor in the early siege of Petersburg. After the war, General Ulysses S. Grant selected Humphreys as the new chief of the Corps of Engineers in 1866. He served in that position until his retirement 13 years later. During this period, he established the Army's first engineer school at Willets Point, New York, served on the Washington Monument Commission and the commission to examine the canal routes across the isthmus connecting North and South America. Matthew Piercy's article, "The Ruthless Hand of War, Andrew A. Humphreys in the Second Seminole War," and his transcription of the Humphreys Seminole War Field Journal are available in the fall 2006 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Well, congratulations to Piercy and you for that prestigious award. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is professor of history at the University of Central Florida, director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at film in Florida and Florida in film.
David Morton is an adjunct professor of history at the University of Central Florida. His research primarily focuses on the history of film in the American context and the intersectionality between history and film. Thus, it is no surprise that in addition to being a faculty member of the Department of History, David is also a part of the film department at UCF. I spoke with David specifically about the history of film in Florida. As David explained, film originated in Florida primarily because of the attention and anxiety the Spanish-American War garnered circa 1898.
Eventually, the entire nation's attention is turned to Florida with the sinking of the USS Maine in February of 1898. And it's here that Edison, who was also a friend of William Randolph Hearst and the New York Journal newspaper, turns to Hearst and decides to basically create a what they call a visual newspaper. And the idea was to, again, further drum up public support for the U.S. to declare war on Spain by sending cameramen down to first Cuba, but also Florida, where a lot of the fallout from the Cuban Revolution and the tension between the U.S. government had begun to build up. So what ends up occurring is that they send a producer by the name of William Paley, who ends up coming down to Key West first to film the funeral procession of the victims of the USS Maine. So this is really the first time, at least from my research, that the public, at least from a moving image context, had seen Florida.
Despite the Battle of Alusty being the only major battle in Florida during the Civil War, much of the early gaze on Florida in film was centered on the Civil War.
So, Kalem Studios' early Civil War films were told from the Union Army perspective. When they come down to Florida, they shift perspective entirely. And one of the major producers and early scenario writers for the studio was a woman by the name of Jean Gontier. And during the first winter session in Jacksonville, she came across a biography of a woman by the name of Belle Boyd, who a Confederate woman who infiltrated Union lines, and she was just fascinated by her story. So she created a character called the Girl Spy, and basically her version of Belle Boyd will infiltrate the Union lines on behalf of the Confederacy. This leans very heavily into the Lost Cause and the same kind of apologist Lost Cause perspective that we later see in D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, where later David Selznick and Victor Fleming's Gone with the Wind were being experimented with in Florida just way before even California got its hands on it.
David expanded this notion of critically analyzing perspectives by transitioning from films shot in Florida about the Civil War in the late 19th century to films focused on the Seminole Wars, specifically Distant Drums, which was released in 1951, and Seminole, which was released in 1953.
What I found very interesting in my research was the contrast between both Distant Drums and Seminole, exclamation point, where these are two films that are shot about a year and a half apart from one another. Both end up fixating on the early stages of the Seminole War and the insurgency that was led by Chief Osceola. In the case of Distant Drums, they rename Osceola Chief Ocala, and he is sort of this very one-dimensional, single-minded villain that becomes very much the embodiment of that black-and-white type of narrative that we would see with indigenous representation in traditional films. And then we have in 1953 Universal's lower-budget Seminole, which in this film, the U.S. Army is depicted as a unjustified occupying force. They focus very heavily on the righteous indignation of Osceola and the Seminole people, but many of the very same types of stereotypes and archetypes that we see in Western films, even if the gaze is attempting to be told from the Seminole perspective, is still rather lacking.
David continued this thread by juxtaposing those mid-century films with Exterminate All the Brutes, a docuseries about the Seminole Wars released in 2021.
Much of the focus on Exterminate All the Brutes looks at moments of genocide that were presupposed under the premise of white supremacy. And Raoul Peck, who is certainly a filmmaker who doesn't pull any punches when he tells a narrative. And in Exterminate All the Brutes, he revisits those same types of archetypes, specifically that dynamic between Jessup and the Seminole peoples. And he reframes it even further by making the protagonist, at least in the first episode of Exterminate All the Brutes, the character of Abby Osceola, who had made a stand against Jessup, and her village was eviscerated by the U.S. Armed Forces under Jessup's order. And I thought it was just a very interesting example of how the Seminole War can be interrogated within these spaces.
These shifting interpretations and perspectives on history throughout time enunciate the indispensability of film as a pedagogical tool.
I use a lot of visual cues and a lot of clips in my lectures, and I do it for twofold reasons. One is it helps to bring the history alive, like when it comes to just the reenactments and giving a visual understanding of, say, this is what the 1830s looked like as opposed to the 1860s or the 1890s. Additionally, then, too, it gives the students an understanding of how views of the past have changed over time and how similar events can be reinterpreted in some very drastically different ways depending on the context of the politics of the period, the motivations of the filmmakers themselves, but also just the moment in time on whose story is being put in the spotlight. And I think that's really why that arc of how Seminole stories over, especially the trajectory of the mid-20th century, changing over time was so interesting.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.